This is something that the ALAC started doing. You know, the ALAC. At one point, it was a hostile player on the registrars. Imposing all these consumer protection demands and, you know, grandma's campaign names and demeanor notes on auction. You guys are evil. As we get into more of these topics, they realize that the registrars are the only people standing up for them. So we've been working with that. Anything interesting come out of the compliance in the last, or is it much?
Smooth and Phileas mentioned the idea of having incentives so that their programmers have something to, like, work toward, and Maggie was kind of like, well, it should be, you know, because you want to. And then there was another person, I don't remember his name, he was talking about having some sort of just a recognition that you could sort of maybe advertise saying that you have 100% in this area.
Mm. I think we might start. So, should we set the recording? Thank you, Gisela. This is the at-large policy roundtable on, I think is it Wednesday? It's Wednesday. First of all, thank you all for coming. I think we might have a very, very quick, could people just whip around and say their name? And with about 1 second, their affiliation. And then we'll start on the first part of the session, which will be on the privacy proxy service, well, actually on much larger issues. But we'll first hear everybody. And, Eduardo, you're going to have to stop reading and tell us what your name is. Thank you. Eduardo. Hello.
Eduardo Diaz, ALAC. Mohamed Bashir Afralo.
Stephanie Perrin, NCSG.
Graham Bunton from Two Cows, we're a registrar.
Tom McKenzie from the OP3FT. I shall be giving a short presentation of the For Against project during this session.
Hi, Stefan Van Gelder. I'm with Tom on the OP3FT.
Sarah Bakke, GoDaddy.
And James Bladel, GoDaddy.
Evan Leibovich, moderator of the second session, filling in for Garth Bruin, vice chair of ALAC. I'd be here anyway.
Holly Roche, Internet Society of Australia, and ALAC.
Heidi Ulrich, ICANN staff.
Silvia Vivanco, ICANN staff.
Gisela Gruber, ICANN staff.
Okay. David Salmanoff, Internet Society of New York.
Yasir Chitamar from AP Raoul.
John LaPrise, Narallo.
Dave Piscatella, ICANN staff.
Thanks. And Gisela, can we start with the slides and can we have a full screen? First.
Oh, hi. Eve Edelson, Lawrence Berkeley Lab.
Carolyn Nguyen, Microsoft.
Get your name and introduce yourself. Dongwon Park, Indiana University.
Thanks. First slide, please.
Maureen, can I introduce myself?
Can we have that? Could I have that bigger? Because right now you can't read it. Go ahead.
Fatima Tasesila, Afralo.
Thank you. I don't want to see a picture of me. I don't. Anthony, you're almost too late. Okay, thank you, everybody. What this is about is, for some of you, this is very, very old territory. Please try and stay awake. For some of you, this is not old territory, but it's important background to understand where we are in terms of both the issue of privacy proxy services, which is part of a larger issue of who is. And for those of you who went to the actual who is session, you will have heard at least a little bit of this anyway, but probably not the full background. That's the order in which I'm going to talk, and some of you, as I say, will know this anyway, but just to keep you all, well, to bring everybody up to speed at the same time. Could I have the next slide? Thank you. This is all about who is and what we really mean, and it was what was said yesterday by the guy from SSAC, was to point out, actually, the registration data is probably a better name, but who is what the term we use, really shorthand, for a bunch of information that is required to be made publicly available. And I'll stop here and say the issue behind all of this is a fundamental tension between, historically, the requirement to make who is information publicly available and the way that it's run right up against privacy laws about 30 or 40 years later. Who is data used to be when a bunch of geeks were the only ones who were on the internet and they wanted to talk to each other, they kind of wanted to know how to get a hold of each other. And that was fine, but that was a long time ago. And the requirement for people to identify who they are and where they are and a lot of information about themselves, which was written into some pretty fundamental documentation a long time ago, is now in clear violation of what is a growing body of privacy law. So we'll go back and say, what is who is data, or what is the requirement? And the requirement is now in the Registrar's Accreditation Agreement. That's the agreement between ICANN and the registrars. I think it's clause 3.1.8. We've all memorized it. Essentially, it says this is what must be made publicly available as part of the who is data. The names of primary, secondary name services, the identity of the registrar, the dates, the name, postal address of, and the registered name holder is another name for registrant. That's the person who actually has got the domain name, has the use of the domain name, doesn't own it. Their name, postal address, email address, etc., and the name, postal address, email address, etc., you can read it. But that is what is included in the who is data that under the RAA must be publicly available. Next slide. Thank you. I'll say next slide, please. I'm being rude. When the issue of who is data, by the way, has been around for a very long time. I was a latecomer in that in 2009 I was involved in the beginnings of negotiation on what to do about who is requirements. At the time, there was a growing concern about the actual accuracy of the data that was held in the who is database. And there are probably two basic reasons why there's inaccuracy. One probably has to do with the fact that the person doesn't necessarily want to be identified because they're a miscreant and they want to cause mischief. The other is a range of quite legitimate reasons why someone doesn't want to be identified, starting with they don't want to be identified, but there are a range of reasons why not. Not the least may be that people don't wish to have accurate information about them. James.
Hi, Holly. James speaking, and I didn't know if you wanted to take questions as we go along or comments, but as a member of the Who Is Review team, and I don't know if there are other members here, I just want to point out that the first bullet point saying that only 23% of Who Is records are accurate maybe is a little, doesn't telling the entire story.
I'm absolutely aware of that. That was why they said the level was inaccurate. Now, I know there were levels of inaccuracy there.
Right. It was not a black and white line. It was very much shades of gray. And I think what we found was that only 23% of WHOIS data records were perfectly accurate.
Yeah.
Some, a vast majority, in fact, had some inaccuracies but still functionally contactable. And then there was a very small percentage that was so inaccurate that it was useless as a point of contact. So there was kind of this spectrum. I'm just pointing this out because I think the bullet point as it reads in this slide is very damning.
James is right. I do remember the review team saying we have to do something about accuracy, and what the review team then the final report then said. I mean, this is by the way the NORC team. Then, and you can read this report still, and you can still actually there's a link there to the final NORC results if you'd like. Oops, I've lost my next slide. That's okay, Kathy. That's fine. You can't read that too well, but what the report pointed out was that, in fact, there are a number of reasons, quite legitimate reasons why somebody would use a privacy proxy service. For individuals, they just might want to protect their privacy. There are a number of organizations, things like Women's Refuges, that certainly don't want their contact information available. Religious groups, political groups, ethnic minorities, and companies as well who are about to introduce new products or services and don't want the information made available for quite sensible corporate reasons. So there are a number of reasons why, in fact, people do not want information about themselves and their names published. But there are also concerns, and it's clear that there has been an abuse by some of privacy proxy services simply to hide who they are. So it's not that everything and everyone who actually uses one is wrong, is bad. It is simply there's a recognition that the final report made, there's a whole range of reasons why people use privacy proxy services, and many of them are sensible, so perhaps we actually have to deal with the issue of what is a privacy proxy service and when is one, when isn't, where are they accredited, who can use them. Next slide. This is what the final review team recommended, that there should be some kind of consistent and enforceable requirement for the privacy proxy services that are, and this is important, consistent with national laws, because increasingly national laws include laws about privacy, and to strike an appropriate balance, which is what we're trying to do throughout. Could I have the next slide? In the 2013 RAA, as a consequence, there was a new clause, Clause 3.14, which set out said registrars have to comply with a specification. I'll tell you what's in the specification. The specification for privacy proxy services was draft. It was part of the actual agreement of 2013, but it looked forward to the development through the GNSO PDP process of developing actually a specification. So there's something that registrars have to comply with until the Privacy Proxy Working Group, and I'm not going to go into that history, comes up with a specification for privacy proxy registrations. Registrars. Next slide, thanks. James wants, okay.
Sorry, just one note on that temporary specification for privacy proxy services. That does have a sunset date.
I know.
Oh, is it in there?
No.
Okay. The sunset date, I believe, January 1, 2017, and that was done deliberately to ensure that the effort to develop a full accreditation, privacy proxy accreditation system did not sort of, you know, go on the pile of someday projects for ICANN, that it got moving and it got formed. And one of our co-vice chairs of that effort, Graham Bunton, is here, and that PDP is well underway to develop that program. So I have to believe that having an expiration date attached to a policy helped move that successor effort along.
I remember from when first joining the working group thinking, 2017, am I going to be involved in calls till that time? I'm optimistic we will meet the date. Okay. This is what registrars must comply with now until the working group comes up with a final specification. First of all, basic thing, compliance is required. And then there are a range of existing requirements, and they are the terms of a privacy proxy service must be publicly available, the identity of the provider, the prices that are charged, how data will be requested, when it will be revealed. And by the way, these are terms I will talk about. How to go from one how to transfer from one registrar to another if you are using a privacy proxy service, how disputes are handled, things about points of conduct, where data is stored, the fact that it should be stored, and then allegations of misconduct, and again, we're dealing with what that term is, have to be relayed. So that's what now is in place until such time as the specification that is now being drafted by the GNSO Privacy Proxy Working Group that's working through what the final specifications look like. Until we've completed our task, that's what has to be complied with. Next slide. Thank you. When we sat down as a working group and thought, what are the thing? Well, and the charter, where there's always a working group is always started with a charter, the list of questions that had to be answered was very long and actually not necessarily in a logical order. So the first thing we did was to say, let's group all of the charter questions that we have to answer into some groupings that are manageable. And so this is the way we're actually, as a working group, working through all of the issues involved in privacy proxy specification. Things like, first of all, what are going to be the tests for accreditation? Who's going to do the accreditation? How's it going to be done? What happens if somebody doesn't comply? What are the sanctions? What's non-compliance? And that's before you start. Then you have a lot of issues about is there a difference between a privacy service and a proxy service? Then you have what information is revealed or not. And by the way, we had to come up with some very clear terminology. Data from a privacy proxy service can be, in the context of that concept, relay simply means that the privacy proxy service provider will get a request from someone that the information, that the information the requester has or the request should be relayed to the customer. It's a request for relay. Reveal is different. It is that the contact or data that is concerning the customer of the privacy proxy service is revealed to a requester, not generally. And then the term publication means information is available generally. So we had to actually agree on to use those kinds of terms to understand what we're talking about. We have, and we have to go through the circumstances in which all apply and there are lots of questions in each of those. We have to deal with issues of transfer, and I'll get to that. And finally, who accredits, who checks, or terminated, and we haven't even got to those issues yet. So we've got a lot of work in front of them, but we're actually making some good progress. Next slide, please. James?
Just through the course of this working group, I think one of the things that we've addressed is this idea, the distinction between reveal and publish, particularly reveal to a single requester and publish. And I think that from a consumer perspective, it makes more sense to, certainly if you feel I'm doing something wrong and revealing it to the complainant as opposed to publishing it in the public who is. But from a provider perspective, and actually something that we hadn't considered, but it makes more sense to perhaps expose it publicly so as not to assume exclusive liability for anything that might be done or misused on the part of that knowledge. So it's an interesting discussion that we can have. Also, it's just one of my little quirks or something, but that says GNSO0 and not GNSO, the letter O, and if somebody could fix that, that would... That's like a splinter in my brain right now.
My apologies.
It's almost like an IDN homographic attack.
Think of it as an IDN variant. It'll be changed. Could somebody make a note that I should change it? Thank you. James, I promise it'll be fixed. Next slide, please. Okay, we have already come to some early conclusions by the working group. Some of this may seem obvious, but that's okay. It's all been discussed. Privacy. You would say, well, the specification requires this anyway, the existing specification. Why are we repeating it? But in fact, we need to, in the specification that will be the product of this group, we need to actually be very clear about what is or isn't going to be required. So yes, we state the obvious, but that's okay. It remains a requirement. Privacy proxy services must relay to their customers any notices required under the registrar accreditation agreement or consensus policies. Sounds obvious, but that's fine. That's one of the things that we'll put in there. Again, transparency in terms of if you want to be a customer of a privacy proxy service, you ought to be able to have full knowledge of what your rights are, what your obligations are, particularly the details about when information will be passed on to you, when it will be revealed, the circumstances under which both will happen, as well as information about transfer. So, in fact, the stuff that's important for a customer of a privacy proxy, a potential customer, they should have some transparency about what they're getting themselves into. Some of the things we've said is best practice, and I will get into more detail because we've discussed this more fully. Things about transfer. I'll talk about transfer in a coming slide. And we're still dealing with this. Privacy proxy services should use commercially reasonable efforts to avoid the need to disclosing a customer data in the process of renewing, transferring, or restoring. Now, that is the intention, and we're still working through what that means. Next slide, please. I think we've gone backwards.
Oh, is there a thing I'm supposed to stand up?
Dave.
So before you leave this, I just wanted to...
Can we go back? Early conclusions. Yep.
As an observation, when you say that privacy proxy service must relate to the customer a notice or an action, In the case of a criminal domain, for example, a domain that's algorithmically generated on a daily basis for a botnet, would that mean that if the domain is actually privacy protected, that the registrar or the privacy protection service operator is obliged to contact the criminal, you know, if he has the ability to say, hey, we're taking down your DGA? Yeah.
I think if you're talking about one, it's to relay to their customer. Are you talking about? Did I say a requirement to tell the customer that their information?
I'm just trying to get a clarification on that because I don't quite understand the consequence to a criminal investigation.
What number are you referring to on that
number
slide?
Number one. Yeah.
Okay, all privacy
on the top number one. So. Yeah.
Must relay to the customers any notices. Yes, you have. Let me back up. And probably go a little bit further, because in subsequent discussions, we have actually started to distinguish between requirements that are from law enforcement agencies and trying to work out the context and the definition of law enforcement agencies versus other things that perhaps are not criminal in nature. And what we have heard from our own chair of the working group is that law enforcement agencies are never going to ask for a relay. They're going to go straight for a tell me who it is. I suspect that's right. Now, in practice, I would imagine, Graham or James, that would be what you'd expect to happen. I don't expect that the law enforcement agencies are going to say pass on.
Right. But just bear in mind that not all criminal activities and takedowns are performed by law enforcement. In fact, that's actually the minority of suspensions. In cases, especially in cases of things like domain generated or algorithmically generated domains for botnets. Yeah. So.
I think we're taking questions now. Stephanie first, and then Annie and Kathy.
Stephanie Perrin, for the record, I just thought that I would jump in here at some point and interject that some of the procedures that have developed at ICANN over the years do not necessarily reflect human rights law. So, for instance, in Canada, it's taken us quite a long time to get a case through the Supreme Court that interprets what is required for law enforcement when accessing telecommunications providers to get my name and address and who I really am. And in that judgment, we have strong language on the right to anonymity. Now, from the human rights perspective, there is a discussion going on at ICANN at 1:15 on the Council of Europe's report on ICANN activity with respect to human rights, notably freedom of expression and privacy. Freedom of association as well. And I think we're going to have to retrofit some of the legal framework onto practice. Now, law enforcement has no problem getting a warrant. They have problems with time delays. They have problems with the fact that the Budapest Convention doesn't work. But they're not the ones that are going to have issues with this. It will be the private sector security guys and the intellectual property guys, who claim, of course, that they're enforcing criminal law because violation of copyright has criminal. But we can all go there. There are criminal penalties in data protection law. So, you know, I expect there's going to be, maybe we'll hit our deadline for this, but I wouldn't be surprised if we have to do a little retrofitting.
Thanks. Kathy?
My name is Kathy Kleiman. I'm with the Non-Commercial Stakeholders Group, and very pleased to be here today. And Holly's explanation is great. Dave, to your point, I don't think number one hits what you're concerned that it hits. Let me give you the background, and if you have any wording changes so that we can focus on what we intend number one to focus on, if it's ambiguous, then we should do that, because we didn't think there was an ambiguity. So all proxy privacy services must relay to their customers any notice this is required under the RAA or ICANN consensus policy. What was happening apparently is that some proxy privacy providers allowed you to check a box that said don't forward anything. But in the process, then you didn't get your renewal notices. You didn't get notices that say, you know, keep your information up to date and accurate even behind the screen. So things were kind of getting lost because people didn't get the right information. This is just saying, you know, if it's official and it comes from ICANN and you'd have to get it as a registrant or you'd have the right to get it as a registrant, you have the right to get it as the customer of a proxy privacy provider. That's the whole idea, is just to take that small set of official notices and push it down all the way.
Like I said, I just asked the question. I'm not going to, you know, go close to trying to sort out the policy in a short period of time. The only thing I'm concerned about with, you know, with the way that we currently have privacy and proxy protection is that from a pursuit of criminal or malicious registrations perspective, the presence of privacy proxy is one more delay in trying to accelerate a suspension of criminal activity. Yeah, and so I just want that to be very much in the mindset of the people who are in the committee. If you know, we all don't want to be phished. If the ideal takedown time is 2 to 4 hours, so that we minimize the harm of a phished domain, then we adding a pass through or some other request to privacy proxy to get some information can be troublesome. We all know how problematic botnets are, and I have if I could be an automation, I would probably be supporting dozens of other security researchers that come to me on a daily basis and say, can you help us with a registrar? Not the people in this room, because they're all actually really good at this, by the way, but there are others who are not, and say, how do I do this? And how do I get through here? And I have 24 hours. If I don't get this, I'm suspend this within 24 hours. Tomorrow the botnet is live again. So I know that law enforcement get court orders. Unfortunately, most of the response to criminal activity and malicious registrations is not done through court orders. And it's just we have a tension in time because I don't know that we'll ever get to a point where we'll have a court order that can be issued in 4 hours.
Thank you for the contribution. One of the reasons for this forum is to actually flesh out the sorts of responses we need as we move along. So that's very useful to the way we talk about law enforcement and criminal activity. Can I have the next slide? I'm hoping we get through. I'll get through these very quickly. Those are some of the early conclusions. I'm not going to go into them. Could I have the next slide, please? We all met on this Friday and reached some of the and I will call them tentative conclusions. In terms of transfer, what James and Graham and others told us is that if it's very difficult to actually transfer, if you are a customer of a privacy proxy service, the situation in which there is very real difficulty in transferring is if you are a privacy proxy service customer and you want to maintain your privacy, can you transfer and there is difficulty. So one of the issues that we're working through is how do you transfer from one privacy proxy service to another without revealing your details? And some of that answer may be in the fact that a privacy proxy service is accredited and going to another accredited one, but we haven't actually locked that down. Could I have the next slide? Another issue is the whole issue of reveal in terms both of what it means and what it requires. First of all, what details are actually revealed, and then under what circumstances. We're working through this now, but it seems to be the case that when registrars receive a request, it's dealt with on a case-by-case basis, and they usually require, we're just calling it prima facie evidence, but some kind of information that indicates that the person requesting the reveal is bona fide and that there's a genuine cause for this. can't do any better language than that. We tried. We're working on the language. And we're also working through whether or not the customer should be told and given some kind of time in which to respond or not. So these are issues in front of us. Next slide. Thank you. This is now we're moving to the EWG, and I thought we'd have time to do this. When the board decided in 2013 to move with a specification for privacy proxy services, what they also did is say we need to think about another way of dealing with the requirement for that kind of contact information to be held, and should we actually rethink the whole structure of who is. That was their characterization, or rather this is Carlton Samuel's characterization of what they said. Could I have the next slide? Thank you. And they've recommended a completely different model. Now, in the discussion on who is, there was a lot of discussion not only on where we're up to with privacy proxy services, but also where we're up to with expert working group recommendations and whether the two fit, whether we should move on both, and whether, in fact, you're going to be asking registrars at some point to change their systems to deal with a new specification and then very closely after that change their systems again radically to deal with the concept of what the expert working group came up with, which is essentially a very large database in which there will be very real efforts for verification of all the data and then a characterization of what data is made public, what isn't, when it's revealed, and so there is consistency. So we in the Privacy Proxy Services Working Group are coming up with one solution, thinking that there may be a different solution down the track, and how these two fit was the subject of a lot of discussion in the final stages of the Who Is session. I think it was Monday. So with that, and almost no time for discussion, I would love discussion. James, have you got anything further?
No, but thank you for putting me on the spot. No, I think... I think probably as far as this issue, this is one of the jokes I made, maybe Kathy remembers, going back to 2009, is that there have been problems with Whois since I've been in high school, and they're still ongoing, and I don't know if you guys know, I'm not high school aged anymore, but I think that, you know, you can always, what's that? Since Dave's been in high school, which is 2 years, after I got there, right? At least. But, you know, and it's the joke, too, is that everybody, you can always spot the newcomers to ICANN because they've got a great idea to fix who is. And I think it's only through an understanding of all the complexities that who is the intersection not only of privacy issues and accountability issues, and now let's put the elephant on the table, surveillance issues, as well as some of the other social issues that kind of bubble up into the internet. They weren't born in the internet, but they're kind of spilling over into this online ecosystem. And I think from a service provider's perspective, we don't want to be harboring bad actors. We don't want that junk on our network. But on the other hand, there seems to be a desire and in fact, a demand from other segments of the community to ingest or infuse some degree of omniscience into who is, that we know who they are, even if they're criminals, and we can tell when they're lying, and we understand their intention before they do something bad. And I think it gets us into a very weird space. And of course, we're all trying to do this and still make a couple of dollars, or euros or whatever. That becomes very challenging whenever you get outside of an automated environment and start having human beings inspect and put all of these systems under a microscope. I think the work is going in the right direction. I think initially I was very concerned that not just as a service provider that's, you know, watchdogging some products, but you know, that as a consumer, you know, I use our privacy proxy service. I tell the story of the Buenos Aires meeting a year ago. I just registered a domain name. I couldn't believe it wasn't registered. And it was a controversial issue in the U.S. at the time, and I couldn't believe that word wasn't taken in .com. And during the Buenos Aires meeting, I received no less than 18 telephone calls on my cell phone within, you know, 48 hours after registering it, asking me what I was going to do. Did I want a web service? Did I want to sell it? Do I want it, you know? And as soon as I said, that's it, I went and I activated, you know, domains by proxy, and it went away. I mean, there's the answer to, I don't want to receive these, you know, communications, these unwanted messages. How does that correspond to a relay, which is someone like Dave? I have to get this message to the person on the other end. I know that it's unsolicited and they have chosen not to receive unsolicited messages. So how do you reconcile the, you know, Dave's a good guy and the message he has a good intention and will better the, you know, better the operation of the internet and the DNS versus, you know, the army of people who may not be so well intentioned. And I think that one of the ideas that we have floated that in the privacy proxy group that's surprisingly enjoying broad support is the idea that requesters of these systems should be authenticated. They should have to create an account, say who they are, and if they abuse that privilege, it should be revoked, and they should be banned from accessing those tools again. And, you know, I mean, that's just one way to try and curb the potential for abuse while still leaving it available for legitimate purposes. I think that there was earlier talk that only natural persons, not businesses, should have access to these services. We've explored, both in the context of the WHO's review team and in this working group, that's not a good idea. Businesses have mergers and new products and all kinds of reasons why they don't want to. And anyone who knows when Apple releases a new product and all the domainers are cruising Whois to see what Apple did they register iPad or iSlate or iTablet, you know, and they were trying to figure out what they were going to name it so they could register all the domain names that were associated with it. These are real world considerations that are a factor, and I think that we're making progress, but I'm not yet ready to say that we have a good idea to fix Whois.
Holly.
Thanks, James. We've got in the queue Evan, we've got Stephanie, and I haven't seen any other, and we've got Dave. And our time is up in about how long?
-4.
-4. Well, it's
actually,
I'll pass. It's his session, so he's going to. I'll have to cut it off after Stephanie and Dave. But first of all, thank you for everybody for being here. And to say this is a very live issue. We are still grappling with a lot of the issues, so any and all contributions are welcome. Now, Stephanie, then Dave, then over to the next session.
Just a few comments. This is Stephanie Perrin for the record. On the expert working group report, I was on the expert working group. It's a massive report, which I encourage you to read. It was kind of a rough consensus from which I dissented on a couple of key points. But let's not kid ourselves. As a privacy advocate and someone who's worked in risk, there's a lot of things in there that I certainly don't agree with. One thing being, of course, right off the top, you have to apply data protection law that exists already, and we're doing it in a backwards way. The risk for the end user has not, in my view, been properly assessed across the board, and we have a public responsibility at ICANN to do that. So, you know, the work on the implementation of the experts working group report is going to start soon. Figuring out what pieces still need a lot more homework, I think, is important. We had an All Things Whois session the other day, but what we don't have is an All Things Whois that looks at end users and what their issues are, because I think James hit the nail on the head. Now we're talking about risk analysis and projection and surveillance of, for market purposes, for personality profile purposes, for surveillance in terms of limiting free speech and freedom of association. And, of course, lots of people want richer data in there, and they certainly want it accurate. From a perspective of big data, we have to watch what we're putting out there. Thank you.
Dave.
Just quickly, James mentioned the need for vetting, and the Anti-Phishing Working Group has begun a program, and it's in its pilot stages with about 15 to 18 CCTLD and other TLD registries, and we're actually talking with the registrars about the program, and it's a voluntary program where there will be a vetted intervener program where, and one of the goals that we have in the future, right now we're starting with APWG members, but one of the goals that we'd have in the future is to bring in people from civil society and from other realms to help us with the vetting process. But the goal is to have a trusted intermediary where we'd be able to submit attestations about a malicious registration. The registrar would be able to say, I have high confidence in this reporter because he's been vetted by parties that I trust, and we'll be able to act on that. And I think this is a really, really interesting model. If you haven't seen it before, and you can please try to either get in touch with me, and I'll share a presentation that I gave on it at an APWG meeting recently. It's a very exciting process because all over I see the need for vetted intervention. And if we can come up with a good model for the vetting and credentialing people, so to speak, who is going to actually do it, I think that this has a lot of merit, not only in anti-phishing, but in other aspects of, who is access and the like. Thank you.
That is fantastic. And I think we will I will bring that. I'm sure we will all bring that back into the discussions of the privacy proxy and maybe even EWG. With that, Heidi's at my shoulder telling me I'm way over time, and Evan's antsy. So thank you, everybody, for this session, and over to you, Evan.
Thanks. Not quite antsy, but that's okay. All right, so we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about something quite a bit different, and it has to do with alternatives and innovations in the realm of DNS. Could you switch the slides, please? And also, could you scroll the...
Yep.
Scroll. Thank you. So I'm working at a little bit of a disadvantage. I'm filling in for Garth Bruin, who can't be in Los Angeles, unfortunately, for personal reasons. So in addition to the bits and pieces of this I know myself, I will try and work to Garth's introduction. And Dave is graciously offered to assist me and fill in the many blanks in what I have to offer to this. So I hope to be spending a very little amount of time talking myself about this and encouraging folks at the table to contribute. It's been a very, personally, for myself, this has been an issue that's been very near and dear to me. I participate in the metrics group dealing with the new GTLDs. And one of the things that is recurring is when they talk about the metrics, is they talk about the competition between the new GTLDs, between the new registrars and registries and business models. One of the things that At Large has been quick to point out is that the competition is not just between the registrars and registries, but between the DNS itself and alternate ways for end users to find the information they want over the Internet. The DNS is one way to do it. Things like QR codes and search engines and social media are another way to do it. But today we're going to discuss actual alternatives to the DNS. So could I get up Garth's slides? Okay, so the whole issue of to DNS or DNS, not to DNS. The chart up there essentially says out of all the sites that are using IP addresses, DNS points to a subset of them, and the number of DNS pointed sites that are web enabled is even smaller yet. And so the question is, so if you're not using DNS to get to web content, what else are you using? Next slide, please. So what we're going to try and talk to about today is alternative routes, dotless domains, the concept of Tor, DNS substructures, and other innovations in GTLDs, such as using creative uses of second-level domains, which I personally am very interested in. Next. Okay, so the questions that we're going to try and raise and hopefully have a little bit of discussion around the table, time allowing, is, you know, where does ICANN come into this? There have been all sorts of root systems. ICANN manages the canonical one that most of the world uses, but there certainly have been many other attempts. How does the consumer deal with it? And so on. So these are essentially some of the questions. One of them is, will other countries or regions split from the single root? Well, a couple of them already have or have created their own duplicate systems. The issue of will domains even matter eventually? Obviously up in the air. We're certainly not going to answer that now. But certainly I think it's worth noting, and it's worth ICANN being aware of the fact that you know, the Internet has a way of working around obstacles, and if the DNS turns out to be an obstacle for the general public, there are going to be different ways to do this. Next slide. Okay. So at this point, talking about other structures, I'm going to turn it over to Dave, who can give a little bit of historical perspective to an idea of, you know, the many attempts that have been made to try and do parallel ICANNs, if you would. Dave?
Thank you, Evan. Dave Piscitello for the record. This is not a new topic. In fact, when I was the fellow for ESAC back in 2006, I wrote about this, and you can tell how old it, you know, the report is because it's SAC document number 009, and I think we're in the 60s. Let me start. I'm going to try to be relatively brief because I know we're behind, and I know that there's lots of other things to talk about. The concept of an alternative route is that instead of going to the authoritative route, you know, that IANA publishes along with VeriSign and, you know, and NTIA and serves as the first query in the public DNS, you go somewhere else. Okay, where else you go depends on the motivation of the operator of this, you know, so-called alternative route. And the purpose of most of the alternative routes is to provide something outside of the normal list of top-level domains. So there, in the report that I'll just have Holly circulate to you, what I did was I went and I did a lot of study back then, and it seems like it's actually still relevant because some of these people seem to still be in operation. But I classified alternative routes into five major groups. One is private name systems. And lots of you may be familiar with the whole name collisions issue. Private name systems actually attempted to create routes within organizations, and then you would literally run your own DNS right from the root within your own organization. So if you didn't want to use any of the public DNS, you could do this. And it was supposed to be completely separate from and distinct from the public DNS. And the reason why we have these name collision issues now is because now there are some of the names that used to be, you know, quote, private names for these organizations are no longer private. There's also experimental name systems, and so people wanted to throw up a TLD and to use it for a very short period of time for, you know, for experimental purposes. It was impossible to get that into the process of actually publishing in the ICANN or the authoritative route. Another was, you know, commercial competitors, people who could not, back in the earlier days, especially in the 2006 timeframe, hope or imagine to apply for and receive a new TLD application that you might be able to do today. And so they simply set up their own structures. Then there were also protest TLDs. There were groups of people who said, I don't trust ICANN, I don't trust the U.S. government, I don't want to have anything to do with the authoritative route, so we're going to create our own. And you know, the politically motivated TLDs, as Evan said, you know, there are reasons for certain countries to feel like they need control over the route so that they can actually control the content and any other communication of their citizenry. There are lots of issues for these, and I'm not going to go through many of them, but from the ALAC or the typical user perspective, the complication of these things is the inability to disambiguate between the public and any of these alternative routes. Lots of these alternative routes, if you go and actually look at their route zone, have names that are in the list of new TLD applicants. They have names that people, you know, wanted to use and they couldn't get from ICANN, and they said, well, fine, I'm going to use it myself. So there's a lot of, I'll use the term adolescence in some of the alternative route. I couldn't get it my way, you know, with you, I'm going to get it my way with me. The biggest problem for users is that you have to have typically some additional software or some additional file in your computer to get you to the alternate route instead of the conventional route, because most modern day operating systems, whether it's on traditional laptops and computers or on mobile devices, has a DNS agent. You know, it has something called a stub resolver, and that stub resolver gets what's called priming information when the operating system starts, and it says, here's where all the root servers are. If, you know, and when it says all the root servers, it means all the IANA assigned root servers, not all these alternative root servers. So you have to wedge something in as one of these alternative providers so that their root service, you know, is either in embedded and replaces the ICANN route, or somehow operates with it, with the ICANN route in a non-interfering fashion. And through all my research back then, I could not find any that could operate with the, you know, unequivocally with the ICANN route. So the concern back in 2006 was fragmentation of the route, because there were people at the time who were, you know, for mostly political reasons, looking to basically be able to have a route that was distinguished from the route that is published by IANA. Let me just end there and say that it's sort of complicated to go into this space. It's not a space that I see even today being particularly large, having a particularly strong influence in fragmenting, except for the politically motivated routes. But even then, the complexity now for political entities that want to separate the route is increased by the presence of a signed zone, a DNSSEC signed route zone. You know, it's very hard to actually it's impossible to make a change to the route zone and have the signature not fail. So you have to do a lot of interesting widging and controlling of anything that your citizens would use in order for the route not to misbehave or to always return unvalidated responses. And so that's just not going to work. And it does, especially not going to work if you ever expect anyone outside of your own controlled citizenry to be able to just come in with their own devices and behave the way they did before they crossed your border. So I don't actually see this as a particular problem. And it never really manifested as a particularly large enough problem to do much more than write a report, explain what it was, and just move on. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Could you go on to the next slide, please? So I'm not going to spend much time on dotless domains. About a year ago, this was a source of... Oh, Olivier, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Evan. It's Olivier speaking. Are we allowed questions at some point or at the end?
If you have questions specifically to Dave on these points, go ahead.
Mike.
Sorry, it's Evan. Olivier, if you have some questions of Dave, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I've noticed a number of examples. What about .onion?
Actually, Olivier, I can answer that because we haven't done that yet. We're about to get to it. We haven't done Tor. So, as said, the issue of dotless domains was extremely contentious within ICANN about a year ago, so I'm not going to rehash it. Just suffice it to say that pretty well every constituency within ICANN came to the conclusion that this was a really bad idea, and so we've essentially moved on.
Next.
Okay, so, Olivier, this is to answer your question. At this point, I'm going to hand the floor over to the folks that can talk about Tor and some similar technologies. So, Tom, would you like to go ahead?
Hi. Thanks. My name is Tom McKenzie, and I work as stakeholder relations for the OP3FT, which is the Organization for the Protection, Promotion, and Progress of the Frogans Technology. So I'm hoping to sort of tell you a little bit about this technology. I can't tell you very much about Tor, as I think our technologies are very different. In any case, I can't claim to know anything about how Tor functions.
Sorry, this is Evan. My apologies. I didn't mean to mix the two together. I guess Garth was hoping to talk more about Tor, did not have this opportunity, so we'll basically skip over this for now, ask you to talk about Frogans, and Olivier, if you can talk a little bit later about Tor.
Thank you very much, Evan. It's Olivier speaking. Just to say, because Tor is hidden, maybe there is someone from Tor, but they're just hidden. No, just kidding. I'm not going to be able to speak about Tor. I don't really know much about it. So but back to Tom.
Okay. We've already dealt with Tor at a previous roundtable of this kind, so we've dealt with that. So, Tom, please introduce us to Frogans.
Okay. So do I have about, is it 10, 15 minutes, something like that? Or
10, closer, you can be
the 10. 10 minutes. Okay. All right. So Frogans. Some of you may have heard of this Frogans project. In fact, I'd be curious to know, I mean, in this room, has anybody heard of this project, the Frogans? One, two. Okay. That's not bad, actually. Others may have heard of it. When going around this conference this week, you know, I've come across people who've heard of it but really don't understand what it's about exactly. And they're sort of wondering what this strange sort of French creature with a sort of reptilian-sounding name is doing in the middle of the GTLD program. And others, of course, have never heard of the project at all. So my aim this morning is just to really tell you a little bit about what it's all about. And to explain to you why we're here, in LA, and why I'm here sitting at this table with you this morning. So the first question, why in LA? Well, that's the easy one to answer. We're in LA because at the ICANN meeting, because the Frogans project includes a new top-level domain, the .frogans. And so in that sense, we're here taking part in the discussions. We're a member of the registry stakeholder group, and we're interested in following the whole process around the delegation of the GTLD. The .frogans was delegated in April this year. The second question, why I'm here sitting around this table, is the more interesting question. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. So to begin at the beginning, to understand this Frogans project, what you have to sort of get is, okay, we are a top-level domain. We've got this .frogans top-level domain, but the .frogans, the most important thing to understand is that we will not be selling or exploiting in any way domain names under the .frogans. The only purpose for which the .frogans was acquired was to secure the infrastructure, the name servers and the infrastructure on which the technology, which is the Frogans technology, will be rolled out, built. And this Furigan's technology is a technology which will allow the publication of a new kind of site, Furigan's sites, which will be small sites, something which quite distinct from web pages. They will be small little sites which will have their own addressing system. So that's why we're here. It's a different addressing system. And they will have, the other sort of feature is that it will require a separate player, a browser, they're called the Furigan's player, in order to show and navigate these Furigan's sites. So I think it's quite important. I mean, I was interested to hear the presentation just earlier about alternative routes and to clear up that we in no sense, or the OP3FT in no sense sees itself as an alternative route. There will be no conflict at any stage with the addressing system, the domain name system. We are the technology, the Furigan's technology is bootstrapped to the DNS, and it is in some ways, I guess the image is it's like a kind of meta system, a meta addressing system, a technology which will be above the existing DNS. I do have some slides. Oh, here we go. I can quickly run through these with you. This first slide is just really to show you where in the internet ecosystem the OP3FT sees the Furigan's technology. It's the position. So on the bottom you have the kind of infrastructure. In the middle you have ICANN and the DNS. This is obviously a simplified breakdown of the layers of the internet, and more often you have six or seven layers, but we've seven, right? It's been narrowed down to three, and we see ourselves at the top as a new application layer alongside the web and email. So it'll be up at that sort of level, and it'll be bootstrapped, if you like, down to the ICANN level with these by means of this GTLD, the Dot Furigan's GTLD. So next slide, please. That quickly, I can go over this quickly. It's just to say that the Dot Furigan's will serve for the naming of the databases on which the Furigan's technology will depend. It was delegated by ICANN. ICANN is a community in which we fully intend to play our part. When you were saying that there is sort of hostility or distrust with some of these new naming systems with the ICANN system, that is really not the case for the OP3FT. We intend to be part of the ongoing discussions of the multi-stakeholder model of internet governance. That's as far as ICANN is concerned. As far as AFNIC is concerned, which is the French registry for the .fr, they are the back-end technical registry for the .fr. Not that they're going to have very much work, because there aren't going to be very many names. There are only going to be five or six addresses delegated under the .furigan's. Next slide, please. This is a slide that was given to me by my technical colleagues this morning, so I haven't really had time to prepare any notes on it. But it's just, I won't go into it now, because I'll be just inventing as I go along. So next slide. This slide is just to give you a sense. It's not a very graphic sense yet of what you will be able to do with Furigan sites. They will be whatever shape you want them to be. They will be simple. That's a very important feature of these sites. They will be ultra light and ultra simple to design and to develop. And the other thing about them is that they will, for developers, they will. The nice thing about them is that they will very immediately, they will only have to develop their site once,
And then it will be accessible across all platforms, all technical, all device types, and all operating systems, without any need for redevelopment. We have developed a special simplified markup language which will allow them to do this. So next slide, please. So this just shows that how more or less what the Sfrogan sites will look like. So you see that they are absolutely identical whether you're on a mobile phone, a tablet, or a desktop computer. There will be a little bit of zooming in feature, so that if you're on a desktop, for example, and want to minimize the size of that screen, you can sort of squeeze it right down to something very small, and the content will adjust accordingly. Next slide. This is what may be of most interest to you this morning, which is the addressing system. I'm here at this meeting this week with one of my colleagues who has been working on the technical specifications for this addressing system, the Frogan's addressing system. It's a Unicode-based addressing system, which means to say that you will be able to use we've got the 10 most used languages in the world, which you'll be able to use to address Frogan's sites. And just the structure of the address is somewhat similar to the domain name system. What you have is that if you look at the top, the Latin one, you've got network name and then a site name. The network name, and then you've got the same thing actually for all the other languages, except in the case of Arabic and Hebrew, where it's the same thing but written in from right to left. If you compare it to the domain name system, the network name is the same thing as the top level domain, and the site name are the second level domains. I suppose one major difference is that we won't have infinitely extendable addresses, so you won't be able to have second, third, fourth level domains. You won't be able to go any further than just the site name. So the technical specification for this is already. We've been here this week discussing with the IDN groups and exchanging with them. I think I'm pretty much done, so I can just go through the remaining slides. That's a slide in 10 seconds, just to tell you that those are the main sort of principles on which the OP3FT which is the organization that has been put this all together, uses. It's a model which is a bit inspired by the ICANN model. And if we go to the end of the slide, this is something which we have been discussing in other forum, which is that as part of the rollout of the project, we will be establishing communities around the world to give us feedback on the technology and how to improve it. Those communities we've started to establish them, and they will be based in universities. This is just to show you that we have a few players in the internet ecosystem who have started to get interested in the technology. So we have on the left some domain name registrars who have become early adopters of the technology, and they are starting not to sell site names or Frogan's addresses yet, but to at least inform their clients that this technology is about to be rolled out. In the middle, you have the dispute resolution centers. So those two dispute resolution centers there are the ICANN, are the same as the ICANN accredited resolution centers, the ADN DRC for Asia and Forum in the United States. And we hope to get more as we go along. And I think we're getting pretty much towards the end. Okay, that's just a summary of the technology. We can go over that. Thank you very much. That's it from me. And if you've got the slides, those are references of the technology.
real fast question. Is there a limit to the length of the site name?
Dave, please identify yourself before you
talk.
Sure.
David Solomonoff, ISOC, New York. Is there a limit to a length limit to the site name? Because you mentioned that there's only one level. You don't have like second and third level.
That's limits. Right. Yeah. There is a limit. I can't remember exactly what that limit is, but it's something like 30 characters or something like that for the network name, and I think it's the same number for the site name. Perhaps less. I'll have to check that with you and get. I can, but it's there is a limit. Yeah, I can give you that figure. I can look it up if you want after.
Dave, go ahead.
This is very interesting, and it,
identify yourself.
One of the things that Dave Piscatello, I can't help but see or draw a comparison between this and apps. You have a specific client that actually enables your participation in the Frogen network. All the only thing that the DNS does in this case is get you to that environment, which then has its own. At own naming convention to go through Frogen's world, so to speak, and these are not connected to a browser. This software is just going to be software that everyone will have. That you'll have one for every operating system, for the client.
Yes.
Is that correct?
This is not. Yeah, that's right. I mean,
the distinguishing feature. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Okay. I mean, it's a self-contained kind of universe which will function on the different devices. There will be our own kind of browser, this Frogen's browser, in order for the Frogen sites to be viewed, navigated.
Okay. Thanks. Next up, we had tentatively here to speak Ken. Sorry? Oh, Olivier, go ahead.
Thank you very much.
Keep in mind our time constraints.
Okay, going to be very quick then. You touched on multilingualism and on what I see as an extension, I guess, to IDNs. Are the label generation rules for IDNs going to be carried into the Frogens as well? Or are you going to have your own... for variants, for example, are you going to have your own rules for any variants?
That's a very interesting question, which we're thrashing out this week. In discussions with the IDN groups, we have been attending all the different panels. In fact, it's my colleague, Benjamin Pfister, who's here this week. We have developed our own rules, actually, for this multilingual addressing system. They're not exactly the same by any means as the rules developed by ICANN, although we have been very inspired by the work carried out here. We cannot yet, as a small organization, we don't have the resources that ICANN has to form groups with large numbers of linguists, but we are very interested to take part in those groups. And so far, the exchanges have been very positive in both directions, I think. And I hope, one of our hopes at the OP3FT is that some of the R&D that we've been doing on the addressing system may be useful to the, who knows? I mean, in all kind of modesty, I mean, we would like to be able to contribute, if we can, also to the ongoing work at ICANN, and would be very happy to share anything findings that we have in that area.
Okay, I have Holly in the queue, but just before that, I don't see Ken Hansen here. Is anyone here either interested or capable of taking his place and talking about the code.com? Because if not, we'll give more time to talking about Frogens. Okay. Having seen not, I have Holly first, and then Gisela has an online question. Holly, go ahead.
I think I shared Dave Piscatella's idea that you're almost talking about an app, aren't you? Or are you? I mean, how do you distinguish... From your diagram, it looked like you've got your basic infrastructure, then you've got your internet protocols and so forth. You seem to be sitting on top of it. Is it from your diagram, you're sitting on top.
It's a bit like an app. I mean, I think it will look very like an app if you.
So why is it and why is it not? Is what I'm asking.
Right. Good question. I might have to think about that. I don't know if I'll be able to give you a good enough answer just like that. But it'll look very much like an app on mobile devices. What you will have is that you will look up in the first sort of stage of getting towards Frogans, you will look up the Frogans app. I mean, yeah, it will be an app, I guess, on the Apple Store or the... Well, part of the rollout of the project has been discussions with Apple and Google and all the stores who will carry the browser. So on mobile devices, it will look very much like an app. You will go to Frogans, and once you've got Frogans, you will be able to open it and then access all the different sort of sites within that universe. On a desktop, Voilà, my French is coming through as well. on a desktop, you will have to download a special player. So will that look like an app? I guess it will be a bit like an app. It's a piece of software that you will have to... Yeah.
Actually, there's a part of this that's really fascinating, but in a certain sense, then, it's sort of like, how different is it from the alternate routes that forced you to have to get in a browser plugin in order to recognize them? It still requires some extra work on behalf of the end user.
Well, from my understanding of the functioning of alternative routes, the problem with them is that they were essentially competing for the same IP resources underneath. I mean, that the addresses were resolving to IP addresses, the same sort of IP addresses, and creating a potential for kind of conflicts with the official ICANN sort of structure. And that's why we need one system of ICANN. Whereas within the Frogans universe, we're not competing. The addresses are resolving down. They're not resolving to an IP number. We're resolving, in fact, in the first stage of the rollout of this project, down to a URL. So it's in that sense that we're sort of above, if you like. We're not resolving down to IPs. So we want to make it sort of clear that we're not one of those alternative routes that's conflicting with ICANN directly.
Got it. Okay, Gisela, we have an online, and then I have Jimmy next in the queue. Gisela, go ahead.
Evan, thank you, Gisela, for the transcript. We have a question from John McCormack, hostestats.com. The question is to Tom. Is Frogans a solution looking for a problem?
No, we hope we're a solution. I think Frogans is a... providing a solution to a real opportunity out there for a need even for a new kind of site. The calculation has been made during the process of developing this project that there are today millions, hundreds and millions of people who are online with a website. So in some sense, it's like, well, why create anything different, you might ask. But what we have calculated at Frogans, or estimated at Frogans, is that there are a hell of a lot of people who aren't online. Included in those people are small and medium-sized businesses who... may just simply not have the time, the resources. Perhaps they consider that they just don't need to be online. If you think of a guy who's renting bicycles in a sort of seaside resort, he might just consider that he's doing his business perfectly well, and that actually sort of having a website is something which is too complicated to maintain, too expensive. And what the Frogan's proposition is going to be to someone like that is, look, for €6, because that's going to be the cost of getting one of these addresses, you can acquire your you can very quickly, very simply, to get your Frogan site out there, and before the end of the day, you will have your little app thing that looks like an app on mobile phones, across the Apple phones, the Android systems, on desktop computers, tablets. You know, it'd be out there, and so. I think our hope is that there is a genuine market out there for this kind of technology. We don't think we're creating a new problem.
Okay, next in the queue is Jimmy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jimmy Schultz from the ALAC. Just to get it right, where is that data stored, which is where is the content stored? When you receive a Frogan site, whatever it is.
Yeah, right. It's hosted under a URL necessarily.
Okay, so it's somewhere on some server you are running. Is that correct?
Not necessarily, actually. Okay. The user could he can have it somewhere else. It could be hosted somewhere else. But it's identified under a URL.
So then I really don't get what's the point here. I could add to that question. What I don't see the problem why we need new protocols, new client software, everything new for something that's already there in place. I don't see it, but it everyone can do what you want.
Well, hopefully next time we'll be able to come back with a future ICANN meeting, hopefully in the not-too-distant future, we'll be able to come back and give you a demonstration. That would be probably helpful to you to see exactly how this system will function.
Okay. I did, but I was sort of in the same boat. John Laprise, for the record. You still haven't told us what the problem is that you're trying to solve. Going back to you're talking, you have marketing opportunity. We don't care about the marketing opportunity. We care about solving problems. And I just didn't hear that in your statement about what problem you're actually solving clearly. You're talking about meeting opportunities. That's a different thing.
Okay.
Sorry, if I can expand on that. To use the entrepreneur parlance, what's the pain point you're trying to address that you're trying to fix?
But what pain point does any app in a mobile device actually try to fix? I mean, to me, this is no different from Twitter or from Vine or from any other opportunity or play to come up with some other kind of disruptive or different environment for users to correspond and communicate. So instead of having to launch a browser all the time, I could have this tiny little footprint, and I can imagine a lot of different. Use cases for this where anything from notifications, I could see banks using this for notifications. I could, today, for example, banks are looking for relief from robotext calling in cases of breach. Maybe this is a more secure way to do it. I don't know what your model is. But that's one example that I could see of this being used right away. I could see that other scenarios where it just becomes another social success, another way to do things, publish things, provide coupons for people. It's just another delivery mechanism.
Right. Okay.
But then let me ask the both of you then, what is about this that could have been done, that could not have been done in, say, Frogans dot something as opposed to having this as a TLD?
Are you talking technically? Technically, absolutely nothing. But marketing-wise, why are 2,000 people getting TLDs?
Right. That's it. Technically, it could have been. There wasn't. We didn't absolutely need to have the .dot Frogans to address the name servers, the technical infrastructure on which this technology is being built. However, a decision was taken at the board level, at the OP3FT, that they wanted to have this TLD because it would send out a kind of signal that we were really sort of in control of the entire sort of system right down, including, well, yeah, the addressing of the server infrastructure.
Okay, thanks. And on that, Tom, you have the last word. We had hoped to have a bit more here on Tor and on co.com, but the people talking about that were not able to come. But I think this has been very instructive on Frogans as an alternative. This is one of the things we've been doing at these roundtables, is trying to introduce alternative ways. I'm sorry if it sounded a little rough, but I mean, this is, I guess, any time you try and introduce something new, that's going to happen.
No. I'm very grateful. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
And so thank you for coming. We are 5 minutes over time, which by at-large standards is early. So on that note, I leave you to your other meetings or the rest of the week. The Naralo meeting starts immediately, two floors up. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for all those in directors, the next meeting.